Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
Thanks very much, Brother John, and thanks to Blackfriars, and thanks to the Thomistic Institute for this wonderful opportunity to talk here. Thanks to all of you. I see many young people. It's a real pleasure to see people interested in spiritual themes, theological themes, all gathered here. It's a pleasure also for me to be here at Oxford University for several reasons. The first is that it was here that in 1983, Sebastian Brock discovered an important part of Isaac's writings, and this created a new interest in Isaac's corpus, in Isaac's thought. A lot of publications are born from this, and so for me, it's a honor to be here. But it's a honor also because Syriac studies have been cultivated in this university for a long time. It's one of the few places in Europe or in the European space where this is done. So here we have a great opportunity to learn this culture and the language. And I had the privilege to study here with Professor David Taylor. It was a great honor, a great professor who respectful of the research of the student and able to guide us through the texts. And it is through the text also that I want to journey with you today. So in the handout, you find several quotations of Isaac that I translated. You find also the Syriac. Not many of you will be able to read the Syriac, but maybe this is a suggestion, let's say, for further study. And at the end, you find the primary sources in English, both editions and translations, recent translation of the headings on spiritual knowledge of Sebastian Brock is there too, very recent, 2022. And then we have a few studies of secondary literature on Isaac. So today we are talking of Isaac the Syrian. I don't know how familiar you are with Isaac. Isaac was a solitary monk. He lived in the 7th century. He was, for a short moment, a bishop of Nineveh due to the effort of the Catholicos George I. But he was born in current Qatar, let's say, or Bet Katraye, the region of the Gulf, and he belonged to the Church of the East. The Church of the East is this branch of Syriac Christianity, which was in the Persian Empire, so Mesopotamia, Iran, but it expanded down to the Gulf region and also had a missionary expansion towards Central Asia and China and India. But it was a minoritarian church, so it has never been an imperial church. Before, it was the majority of the people were Zoroastrians, and then, after the fall of the Sasanian Empire in 651, we have Islam gradually taking over. And so it's a church which has always been marginal in a way, although communities were thriving. Marginal, at least from a more Western or Greek perspective on Christianity. And nevertheless, it was a church in which, in the 7th and 8th century, there was a blossoming of ascetic mystical writings. In particular, we have Isaac of Nineveh, but we also, Isaac is, of course, the main exponent of this movement, but we also have Dadisho Katraya, and we have Simon of Taibute, always in the 7th century, and in the 8th century we have John of Daliata and Joseph Azaia. These two mystics were condemned by a synod by the Catholicos Timothy I, but the successor rehabilitated them, and their writings became central for the Syriac spiritual tradition. So it's not only Isaac the Syrian, but it's a kind of a universe, a spiritual sensibility, if we want. This church, this is important to bear in mind, has been labeled as Nestorian for a long time because it did not accept Ephesus and Chalcedon. But, of course, this label is quite misleading. We have to bear in mind that the main theologian for them was more than Nestorius, Theodore of Mopsuestia. And Theodore of Mopsuestia is central also for Isaac. We will see the special perspective of Theodore that Isaac inherits. But together with Theodore, we have other influences in Isaac, especially Evagrius Ponticus. So if you want, Evagrius inherits the tradition of Origen. So we have Theodore, Antiochian, and a more, let's say, Alexandrian line of thought, although the main line of thought in Isaac's church is Antiochian. But we have Evagrius, and Evagrius is a teacher of the spiritual life, a teacher of the ascetic mystical path for them. Then we have John the Solitary. He's a great author, only in part edited, autochthonous from the Syriac area, writing in Syriac. And then we have several other influences, Pseudo-Dionysius, we have Mark the Monk, Abba Isaiah, Palladius with the Historia Lausiaca, the Apophthegms. So we see Isaac was inheriting a big culture. And nevertheless, his writings is not directly theoretical or directly theological, but it is experiential. So the interest of Isaac is mostly in the journey of the human being, in the dynamics of the inner experience, in what Benedict might call querere Deum. So that's what he's interested in. And he writes for disciples who share the same interest. But we have to bear in mind that he does this coming from this background of a wide culture. So not only feeling, but really also thought. And although he is unsystematic in a way, his thought is extremely coherent. To come back to his life and to his writings, so Isaac became a bishop of Nineveh, but after 5 months he renounced and he went to live on the mountains of Khuzestan in southwestern Iran, where he shared the life of monks of the region. It was a semi-eremitical life, so it was not a cenobitic life, but it was not a life of complete isolation. And he had disciples. We know that his writings were written for disciples. So they have a kind of a dialogic tone, right? He often speaks to his beloved, or he speaks of fathers he goes to meet. So it's extremely dynamic. And what do we have of Isaac today? So we have the first part, 82 discourses, and this was very important because it was translated into Greek in the end of the 8th, beginning of 9th century in Mar Saba, a monastery near Jerusalem. And from there it passed to Orthodox Christianity, so that Isaac became a foundational author for Hesychasm. And from there, he passed into Slavic, so Paleo-Slavic and then the Slavic languages, and became an essential reference also in the Russian culture. And we have up to an influence which is not only in monastic circles, but also, for instance, and especially in Dostoevsky, in the Brothers Karamazov, the figure of the Starek Zosima, but also other ideas expressed in the novel, really comes from Isaac. From this Greek translation, there were translations also in other languages, and one is Latin. Of course, in the Latin West, Isaac was not as influential as in the East, Syriac and Greek, but it had an influence. So 50 discourses of the first part were translated into Latin, and they were very much appreciated in the milieus of the spiritual Franciscans, but also Dominicans. I recently discovered new of Isaac and other religious orders. His figure merged with a figure of Syriac Isaac, who lived near Spoleto and founded an eremitic colony there, and Isaac of Monteluco. And the person who speaks of this Isaac, so not our Isaac, but this Isaac, is Gregory the Great in the Dialogues. These two figures merged, and therefore Isaac became a reference also in the West. And an interesting point, this is interesting for contemporary research, is that Tourneisen, a theologian who was a friend of Karl Barth, he was a lover and a scholar of Dostoevsky, and he highlights especially passages of Dostoevsky where there is an influence of Isaac. So an Italian scholar, Salvestroni, she's a scholar of Dostoevsky, hypothesized that Isaac had an influence also on Barth. Of course, it's indirect, very indirect, so we can doubt about it, but it's interesting to think the way his thoughts is transmitted. But today we are going to talk about finitude. So finitude is a specific way Isaac has to speak of anthropology, which is the theme of the Thomistic Institute for this year. So the reflection on anthropology and therefore on creatural finitude is central in Isaac. And we can also say that the quest for God itself is rooted into his reflection on anthropology. So the quest for God, we will see, is rooted in questions which emerge from a quest which is related to the condition of the human. So when we say that today we do a theological study of Isaac, it is true, but it's not an abstract theology, but the theology whose questioning about God is born from experience. This is very important for me to highlight. And in this sense, it has also a universal significance which goes beyond boundaries, as actually happened also through history, as we can see. I want to explore this theme in three steps. So the first is to understand how Isaac conceives the human condition. The second is what Isaac calls weakness, Syriac mechiluta. It's a technical term in his corpus, very important, and I want to explore with you what it means. And then I want to see how Isaac outlines a process of relationship with weakness and what this has to do with the birth of a certain approach to faith and to human radical solidarity. So to see how the relationship with oneself, with one's weakness and finitude, what this has to do with the vertical dimension, so the relationship with God, and the horizontal dimension, the relationship with other creatures, human beings, and we will see other creatures. So we have first to keep in mind that for Isaac, the world in which the human being lives, it's extremely limited. Let's read together the first passage. God made your nature a receptacle of accidents, and in the world in which he created and left you, he multiplied the causes of accidents and trials. He made your nature a small receptacle for these things. Evils are not far from you, not very far at all. They sprout from within you at this sign, and from below your feet, and from the place where you are. As the upper eyelid is close to the lower eyelid, so trials are close to human beings. So actually, our condition in the world, it's a condition of subjection to trials and difficulties, and God did not make us impassible, and God didn't make us not subject to inclination. We will examine this concept in a while. This condition of limitation, what is the first place of the perception of this condition is the body, because the body is part of the world, so the body also is mutable, is corruptible, and so the reflection of Isaac on mortality becomes primary, because our condition is a condition which will end, in a way, at least in the physical body. We can see from the second quotation how Isaac is sensible also to the suffering of the body. We have several passages on illness in his writings, and we see, for instance, this. It's a prayer for those who suffer from harsh illnesses and grievous infirmities of the body. Send them an angel of compassion and soothe their soul, which are tormented by the vehement afflictions of their body. But the problem of finitude is not only a problem of suffering, but it's also related to the problem of sin. Let's see how. In the quotation that follows, we have a peculiar idea of Isaac that I want to examine with you. We did not become mortal because we sinned, but because we were mortal, we were pushed to sin. Some of you might have in mind Romans 5:12 of Paul, where it is said that it is from sin that death came. But Isaac here is saying something else. Of course, it's not in order to contradict Paul, that is one of the main sources in Isaac, so this is not his intention. But he wants to focus on the fact that it is an ontological problem, the problem of our limitation, of our radical finitude, that leads us to defensive reactions against this problem, which lead to sin. And these defensive reactions for him are the passions. In the monastic discussion of sin, the origin of sin is related to the passions, greed, envy, pride, these kind of things that then became also the vices, no, in the West. But in the original reflection of Evagrius Ponticus, these are 8 original thoughts which lead to passion. If you listen to the thought, you will follow a passion. And if you follow a passion, you will fall into sin. That's the idea. So for Isaac, these passions are caused by our fear of our finitude and mortality. And this is also fear of suffering, as he says in another quotation. One of the saints said, "The body becomes a companion of sin because it fears afflictions of being tormented and dying to its life." So actually, this conception comes from Theodore of Mopsuestia. Theodore has 2 ways of conceiving the problem. One is the traditional one, from sin that came, and the other is this one. And Isaac openly and with fervor, we can say, supports this second view. But it is not only the body to be limited, but also the soul. We found the word inclination before. This is an Antiochian context, an Antiochian concept that indicates free will, so the capacity to incline on one side or to the other side. But for Isaac, it's also a kind of tendency to error. So to incline in the sense that it's a possibility of fall. So you can fall. And that's inclination, and for Isaac, it's distinctive of the soul. And another aspect of limitation of the soul, which is ontological, is that after death, the soul will sleep. This is a conception distinctive of his church. So the soul will sleep until God, with his powerful and omnipotent hint, will awaken the soul in the final resurrection. So in a way, this idea highlights once more the creatural nature of the soul. And then there is the other problem of the soul, which is subjection to passionality. And subjection to passionality, we have seen how it is born. And what I want to highlight concerning this idea is that Isaac, with this idea, proposes a precedence of the negative, we could say, in the sense that at the origin of human experience, so at the origin of creation in Adam, but therefore in all of us, there is an element of imperfection, of incompleteness, an aporetic element, if you want. And therefore, the problem also of the moral fall, the problem of sin, is not only moral, but primarily it is rooted in a certain way of dealing with an ontological problem. In fact, we have seen in the second quotation that the problem is fear of mortality. It's not mortality per se. The creature has fear to suffer, has fear to die. And highlighting the problem of fear means highlighting that the problem is not mortality or suffering per se, but the problem is our relationship with it. And I believe this is extremely modern. So it means there can be the possibility of a different relationship with these elements. And this is precisely what the solitary in his journey look for. So a different relationship with the conditions of limitation and finitude. And this is made possible by the fact that Isaac conceives, following the tradition of John the Solitary, the soul as non-passional. So there is a core of the self which can be free of passions. Isaac, in fact, thinks that this inner non-passional core of the self can be in relationship with other elements of the self, the thoughts we have mentioned before, the passions, and through this exercise of relationship that can become strong and free from these influences. We can read, for instance, some passages which indicate this relational movement of the soul. "Observe yourself continuously, my beloved. Enter within yourself continuously. Which of the passions do you see to have grown feeble in your presence?" And again, "The solitary should always remain before God's presence if he want to seize quickly the small points which trouble him and to learn to discern in the peace of mind the thoughts which enter and go out. So you can see how he outlines the dialectic between, let's say, a subjective pole of the self and an objective pole of the self. We will see how this is important also in the transformative journey of askesis that we will examine in a while. We have seen then the condition of the body and the soul, its limitation. And facing, when the subject faces this limitation, the first movement is the attempt to transcend this condition. And for Isaac, this desire is justified because God himself is conceived as a consolation of suffering, a liberation from suffering. Let's read this beautiful passage where Isaac says, "All will receive fulfillment when our Lord will rise from heaven above all. And he will raise us from the dust and will give renewal and liberation from suffering to us and to the whole of creation and will make all ascend with him to the heavenly dwelling." So the movement of faith is not a movement which is only mental. We will see it also at the end. So adhering to a confession of faith, but is a movement of trust in a God who is conceived as liberating from suffering. And nevertheless, Isaac has a strong awareness that this liberation is not possible on earth. And so we find in his corpus this kind of sentences: "Since human nature has not yet been raised above the order of mortality and the weight of the flesh, it cannot be completely in that spiritual state which is above inclination. The provocations of the passions do not cease until the world exists. There is no perfect freedom," in fact, he writes, "in an imperfect world." So we can see between these two poles, his reflection unfolds. And it is precisely at this point that the concept of weakness emerges. Weakness in Syriac is mechiluta, but Isaac also uses several other terms that you can find on the second page of the handout. So weakness actually for Isaac should not be understood as we speak sometimes of this theme in a contemporary common discourse, let's say, where we say we have to accept our weaknesses in the plural. So for him, weakness is an ontological condition and is the condition of exposure to suffering and death that is distinctive of human beings. So it's not easy to accept that, imagine. So it's something which creates a problem. You can reach the point of accepting, but it's not as easy as we might imagine following common discourse. And on the other hand, we also have not to think that weakness is only moral, so like a moral failure or the weakness of the creature, the moral weakness of the creature, for instance, when grace instead fulfills this weakness. This is an aspect of weakness, but it's not the only one, because we have seen there is an exposure to suffering of the body, an exposure to mortality. So it's something ontological, and the moral problem is born within this wider ontological context. And I have to mention here that the first person to talk of this problem of weakness was André Louv. Some of you might know André Louv. He was a Trappist monk, and he also translated part of Isaac's writings into French. He spoke a lot of weakness within his works, and also shed some light on this concept in Isaac. And also Sabino Chiala, the editor of the third part, highlighted how this term and this concept is central in Isaac. But I want to focus with you on a passage from the Centuries of Knowledge where we can see how weakness is discovered. Isaac is speaking of the martyrs, and the martyrs were made insensible due to the power of God, who is the Holy Spirit here. So the power of God was making these people insensible to their suffering, the suffering of the soul, but also the suffering of the body. But something happens at a certain point. Let's see. "Some of the martyrs were seeing this power in a perceptible way, and at the time of the vehemence of the torments, it was appearing openly to many of them. Many times also, the suffering of the body was taken away from them, as one of them said, 'As every limb was torn asunder from him, he was filled with exultation and was raising a hymn of joy to God, while his mouth was full of laughter and exultation. when it happened that they amputated one of these, his inferior limbs, which was the knee, in this limb, he suffered. And when they asked him why, he told them something which is true. You should know that when you were amputating all of my other limbs, I was not suffering, and my mind was wholly in heaven. But for this limb, I was allowed to suffer, so that I might know that I am a human being. There is a pseudo-Makarian background to this affirmation. I cannot focus on this now, but maybe in the discussion we can talk also about this influence. So Isaac basically is saying here that only an experience of suffering can make us aware to be human. So this is the dynamic that he's describing here. And you will recognize in this dynamic something which is already in Paul, especially in 2 Corinthians 12, 7, 10, but is found everywhere in Paul's corpus. But of course, the main passage is this one, is the passage concerning the thorn in the flesh. And I want to read it with you. So that I might not boast of the abundance of the revelations, a thorn was given me in my flesh, a messenger of Satan, to buffet me so that I might not be exalted. Concerning this, I asked the Lord 3 times that it might depart from me. But he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is accomplished in weakness. Here Paul does not use machiluta, that is the term that Isaac most often uses, but use krihuta. But krihuta, Paul, I want to say the translation of the Peshitta that Isaac read, so the Syriac translate the Greek with this krihuta. But nevertheless, this term is present in Isaac. So we find krihuta, we find the other terms. So this passage is really behind Isaac's reflections, as Isaac also stated one time openly commenting this passage for one homily. So actually, I am a human being, and I know this because I suffer. So suffering makes one aware of one's human condition of weakness. And the thorn of Paul, therefore, corresponds to the experience of suffering. This knowledge of true suffering is not only mental, but it is experiential, because it involves one body and soul, flesh and blood. In fact, Isaac traces detailed phenomenologies of this experience, and in all of them, he insists on the concept of knowledge of weakness, idaita de mechiluta, knowledge or awareness, because in Syriac, does not refer to intellectual knowledge alone, but also to experiential knowledge. We can see this particularly in a passage where Isaac puts together the verb to know, ida, and the verb to perceive, argesh. And this verb, argesh, it's really the verb of also physical perception. Let's read this passage. Blessed is the person who has known his weakness, mechiluta. This knowledge will be for him the foundation and beginning of all good and beautiful things. When a person has known and perceived that precisely in the truth he is weak, then he restrains himself from scattering, which is the dispersion of knowledge, and increases his watchfulness over his soul. But if he is not allowed to be a little imperfect, if a small act of negligence does not occur to him, or if the tempters do not surround him with the pains of the body and the suffering of the soul, a person cannot perceive his weakness, again, argesh. So basically, we see here that if there is imperfection, negligence, the tempters, the pains of the body, the suffering of the soul, all this makes one aware of his weakness, and of this person, Isaac says, this person is blessed. But how does it work? Why it is so? So actually, Isaac conceives as the solitary journey, which traditionally is structured in an ascetic moment and in a contemplative moment, as a way of deciphering this blessedness, let's say. In fact, the ascetic journey and the solitary life is conceived as an initiatory process as a mysterious place of transformation. He says, for instance, that the honorable practice of stillness is a haven of mysteries. The cell is the cave of hard rock, or the cleft in the rock, where God spoke with Moses. That's Exodus. The solitary life is the furnace of Babylon, Daniel, where one is tried like gold. So from this being tried like gold, something can emerge. And this, for instance, for Isaac, is the contemplative opening, the contemplative openness that can emerge. But we would mistake Isaac if we would think that it's suffering per se that has a value. Suffering has value because it teaches the person, if the person listens, a relationship with him or herself. And in this sense, there is a passage of Isaac that I find particularly telling, although it's made of images, so it's not theoretical. What I'm going to argue that he says is not theoretically or openly expressed, but I believe it's very telling. Here Isaac speaks, inspired by the image of the pearl diver, who was Isaac came from the coast, so we know that metaphors related to the sea or to swimming and to diving were familiar to him, coming from everyday life. He speaks of the pearl diver as somebody who encounters difficulties, and these difficulties teach him to swim, teach him to dive. Let's see. Isaac speaks of a noetic swimming of the intellect, of descending to the earth of the heart, to the heart of the earth, unlike to make the body's movements dive down to deep places in which it is not easy for everybody to swim. He speaks of profound depths in which our fathers swam, of descending to the abyss, which holds riches, descent into the abyss. He speaks of waves assailing the person, of marine beasts encountering him. He speaks of holding the breath up to death, of deprivation of clear air. He speaks of a fearful sea, and he calls the solitary life the rough sea of stillness. And he also says, if a diver found a pearl in every oyster, everyone would easily become rich. If he brought a pearl up as soon as he dived, pearls would be more frequent and numerous than pebbles. So you can see how all these difficulties that the diver encounters teach him how to swim, how to dive in order to find the pearl. And Isaac has a strong awareness that the difficulties that one encounters are real difficulties. For instance, he speaks of difficult precipices that one encounters in the journey, of appearances of truths that are frequently found on the paths. And you can see in the first page, if we go a bit, we come back to the first page, how rich is the vocabulary of related to suffering in his corpus, how rich and detailed. So he has a strong awareness of how dangerous is this diving. And for this reason, he outlines the need of being in a relationship of trust with a spiritual guide who guides the person in this journey. He says that you need an enlightened man who is experienced in these things, so that one might be enlightened and comforted by him from time to time. Then he adds, not all the time, however. So one should also do something alone. But this insistence on the need to be guided of a relationship of trust indicates how difficult is the journey. So he is really aware of this. Within this journey, Isaac is inspired by several sources. One, for instance, is Evagrius, who speaks of abandonment. Meshtab Kanut in Syriac. The soul can be abandoned for a pedagogical reason by God. Then we have Pseudo-Macarius, the Syriac Pseudo-Macarius that he inherits, where Macarius speaks of the changes between good and bad experiences, Shuklafe, and these changes are interpreted as the atmospheric, the changes in the weather, basically. And one should need to be in relationship, as I said before, with these different experiences. We have other elements, of course, that indicates this process of relationship, but I believe that the main element which really connotes Isaac Todd concerning this process is what I called often bearing. And I call it bearing because Isaac himself uses often a vocabulary related to bear. In particular, he uses ten and sebal, which means to bear, but then he has several other terms, saibar, to endure, hamsen, to hold fast and persevere, mesaibranuta, endurance, patient endurance, etc. But we don't have to think that it's only a matter of resistance or endurance. Because, in fact, Isaac uses ten and sebal, which means to bear. In particular, ten means to bear a burden, so to put yourself below in order to sustain this burden. And he also speaks of remaining, using the verb kwa, to abide or to remain. What I want to highlight, showing you this diverse vocabulary, is that Isaac conceives bearing as the fact of sustaining a weight, remaining in contact with something firm and stable while perceiving this something. So we can interpret this also as a way of finding a relationship with this something, and this something is precisely the experience of the negative. So you put yourself under something to bear its weight, perceiving it, and stay. And this staying, in fact, is often expressed by the idea of sitting in the cell. That's a traditional idea in monasticism. It's not an invention of Isaac, but he speaks, for instance, of a perseverant sitting in the cell. So while you sit in the cell, everything can happen, but you remain firm. So the cell becomes like a symbol of this remaining, a symbol of this inhabiting a condition of also negation and negativity. I use the term inhabit here. This term is often used in the sciences related to phenomenology in the previous century. In particular, I find the use also in a psychoanalyst and philosopher, Pessina, who conceives the fact of inhabiting, speaks of regressing consciously toward the unconscious in order to find its secret, assume its secret, without triumphing of this dimension or removing this dimension, so staying there. Of course, Isaac's context is another context, but I find interesting resonances also in this conception. And concerning this, let's read together some very important passages in which Isaac defines as perfect practice of God the fact of dwelling there in contact with also negative and contradictory experiences, especially the passions. The human being who does not receive on himself, rejoicing in them, heaviness, sloth, listlessness in the office, in order to bear their difficulties with gladness, and suffocation and darkness, and the rest of the griefs of the cell, as necessary for the perfect practice of God, but desires complete deliverance from them, he is handed over to the spirit of fornication. And again, believe me, my brothers, listlessness, dejection, heaviness of the limbs, tumult and confusion of the mind, and the other sad things which are allowed to occur to ascetics while they sit in stillness are the perfect practice of God. Do not think that luminosity in the office, cleanliness of mind, delight, exaltation of the heart, and limpid converse with God alone are divine practice. I speak truly and according to my conscience. The thoughts of blasphemy, vainglory, and the hateful movements of fornication, also this is reckoned to be a pure sacrifice and a holy and divine practice, except for pride alone. Because the person perseveres in the struggle of the Lord in all things, those of the right and those of the left. So basically, here Isaac is describing a specific position of the subject who is in contact with all this negativity, stays there without trying to cancel this experience. So what is the perfect practice of God is not the passion in itself, but it is the subjective attitude before this passion, this attitude of remaining strong and firm before this. And within this experience, actually, for Isaac, a transformation can become possible. Isaac, for instance, says, if there is someone who reckons as being outside the path and errors, listlessness, darkness, and the confusion of the mind, and teaches and announces to you a single order full of joy, know that he leads you out of the path of God, and he wants to hand you over to the error of the demons. So basically, if you just look, that's the thought of Isaac, for luminosity, cleanliness of mind, and these elements, you are not loyal to the reality of life. There is also this other side in life. And if you look for God, and if you look also for a human truth, we could say, you have to deal also with this. But there is an experience that Isaac calls darkness, Amtana, thick darkness, Eshuka, Eshka, which challenges this perspective. This experience that Isaac calls darkness is an experience of extreme dejection, where every consolation of faith, that's the specific phrase he uses, is utterly effaced from the soul. So you cannot feel your God anymore, but you can also not feeling the reason behind your choice, of course, because you don't feel anymore that possibility of liberation of suffering we saw at the beginning. So it's a condition of utter dejection, and Isaac describes it in these terms. Our soul is suffocated, and it is as though amidst the waves. If a person draws near to scripture, to the office, or to all he approaches, he receives darkness upon darkness, and he leaves it aside. How many times he's not even allowed to approach these things. He cannot believe at all that he will again receive a change and be at peace. This hour, and hour here, it's a reference that is also more direct in Isaac to the hour of Gethsemane, so the dark hour of Gethsemane. So this hour is full of desperation, Pesach Sabra, and fear. Hope in God and the consolation of faith are completely effaced from the soul, and the soul is utterly filled with doubt and fear. Mighty blasphemy is also joined to this, and sometimes also uncertainty concerning the resurrection. Frequently have we experienced all of these things, and we have written them down for the consolation of many. So actually, this condition implies a loss of the meaning of one's choice, the meaning of one's life. And Isaac synthesized this as a specific suggestion that Satan suggests, that you can find in the following quotation. The entire concern of Satan is this, to persuade the person that God does not care about him. And again, by those who lie in ambush and shoot their arrows in darkness, who are the demons, it is continuously suggested he will not be happy at all times if he trusts God, and God does not care about you as you suppose. So Isaac here is very explicit. So what is the problem in this condition of darkness is not a theoretical doubt concerning the nature of God or the attributes of God, but it's a doubt about his care, his providential care for the subject. So you see how this has an existential weight, in a way, and can lead one to question the whole journey of his life, his or her life. For Isaac, in particular, it's also a trial of faith. As we saw before, consolation of faith is effaced. And Isaac calls it noetic genna, or Sheol. But Isaac calls noetic power instead a new form of faith that can be discovered. In Isaac, we find two ways of speaking of faith. This is something that he inherits from Mark the Monk, who also speaks of these two faiths. One is the faith taudita, which means the confession of faith, that for Isaac is extremely important, but has not the same role of the faith to Klana. And the faith to Klana is the faith trust. To Klana means trust. And so Isaac says that only the faith to Klana can really be a solution to this noetic gena. The faith that dissipates fear, in fact, is not that faith which is the foundation of the confession of the Christian community, but that noetic power which sustains the heart through the light of the mind and through the testimony of conscience steers in the soul a great trust in God. For him, of course, there is no contradiction between the two. It's like one is within the other, right? So you have to access to it. One is the true meaning of the other. Actually, we could put it in this way. And therefore, the perseverance sitting in the cell would be in this condition of prostration and dejection, the attempt to find back this faith trust. And sometimes this faith trust cannot be found back. So what you have to do is just to remain there in this utter place of lowliness, if you want. And something might mysteriously emerge at this point, and this something is precisely this faith and is at the same time the contemplative experience of grace. There is a description of this experience, which is born from this very extreme form of bearing, that we can read and comment them together. After much converse with the scriptures, continuous supplication and the acknowledgement of his weakness, with his gaze extended unceasingly towards God's grace, following great dejectedness in stillness, from here, little by little, some spaciousness of heart is born in a person, and a germination which gives birth to joy from within, although this has no origin from that person himself. He's aware that his heart is rejoicing, but does not know the reason why. Why, he does not understand. There is no one who can understand the nature of these things which occur with him as a result of God's grace. This alone can be said. Blessed be the person who, out of hope for God's grace, has endured, Saibar, the term we found before, has endured the dejectedness, which is a hidden trial of the mind's virtue, and grows. It is like winter's sadness, which causes the hidden seed to grow as it disintegrates under the ground at the harsh changes of the blustery weather. I took here Sebastian Brock's beautiful translation for the last sentence because I really think it gives the idea, the harsh changes of the blustery weather. And of course, the image of the hidden seed that grows is John 12, 24, 26. So there is all a constellation of meanings, of evocative meanings in this sentence. So you can see, if we look at this sentence as a kind of a comment to experience, we can see that the person experienced that this transformation, this germination comes from within. So it's deeply belonging to the subject, but at the same time, it's not a matter of the will. In fact, Isaac speaks of grace. It's not a matter of the will. The person knows that this has no origin from him or herself. He does not understand how this happened. He does not know the reason why. Nevertheless, this comes at the end of a metabolic process, we can say, but it is grace. So the role of the human being actually is this remaining, this sustaining the weight of experience. And then what is beyond that is the mystery and is not up to the human being. I believe that in this way, we saw how the fact of developing a relationship with one's own finitude and with one's own limitations and weakness can open one up to the vertical dimension and the experience of God in contemplation. But for Isaac, this is not the end. Because for Isaac, there is also an attention to openness to human beings and also to other creatures. For instance, we have wonderful passages, cover the sinner, sustain the weak and the distressed with your word, so that the right hand which supports everything might sustain you. Love sinners and reject their works. Do not treat them with contempt because of their faults. lest you might also be tempted by the same. Remember that you share the stink of Adam, and that you are also clothed with his weakness. We see this ontological solidarity of all human beings in weakness. And I believe it's the perception of this that allows Isaac to write words which are even stronger than the one we read. And we read the last quotation where he expresses this quite graphically. What is a merciful art? It is the burning of the heart for the whole creation, for human beings, birds, wild animals, demons, and for all that is. At their remembrance and sight, his eyes let tears fall due to the vehement mercy that is pressing on his heart. For because of his great compassion, his heart is brought low, and he cannot bear to hear or observe any damage or small suffering of anything in creation. For this reason, he offers prayers with tears continually, even for irrational animals, for the enemies of truth, and also for those who harm him, and that they might be protected and strengthened. Even for the reptiles, he prays, because of the great compassion that is poured out in his heart without measure in the likeness of God. And this is the God that he encountered precisely through this process of relationship with his weakness. Thank you. I think we can open the Q&A.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.